Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 16th of September. This hour of the program, senior writer for Slate Magazine, Timothy Noah, will be joining us. He has written an extensive series of articles on income inequality in this country and looked at where we've been historically when it comes to income and where we are now. He's a senior writer at Slate and previously was an assistant managing editor at U.S. News and World Report, a Washington-based reporter for The Wall Street Journal, a congressional correspondent for Newsweek magazine, editor of The Washington Monthly, and a staff writer at The New Republic. He's also the editor of two collections of writings by his late wife, Marjorie Williams, the award-winning The Woman at the Zoo and Reputation, both published by Public Affairs. Marvelous book, The Woman at the Washington Zoo. It was a great treat to read that one. So this should be a very interesting show because we keep wondering where the wealth is and where the wealth was and what about tax rates in this country. When have they been high? When have they been lower? When have they taxed the wealthiest among us at much higher rates? Has that made a huge difference in income inequality? What does make a huge difference in income inequality? We'll be looking at a number of issues. He writes in part one of this series, in 1915, a statistician at the University of Wisconsin named Wilford King published The Wealth and Income of the People of the United States. The U.S. was displacing Great Britain as the world's wealthiest nation, but detailed information about its economy was not yet readily available. The federal government would not start collecting such data in any systematic way until the 1930s. One of his purposes was to reassure the American people that we were all sharing in the country's newfound wealth, and he was troubled to find that the richest 1% possessed about 15% of the nation's wealth. Well, now the situation is that the richest 1% account for 24% of the nation's income. What has caused this to happen? We talked to Timothy about this and welcome your phone calls, as we always do. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Timothy. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. Give me a little bit of a history of when perhaps there has been more income equality, when it was really at an extreme.
Well, the when you look at the 20th century, what you find is that, yes, the beginning of the 20th century, as Wilford King observed, there was a great deal of income inequality. And you know, around 1915, when King was doing his research, that was really kind of the high watermark of radicalism in the United States. The income inequality surely had a great deal to do with that. You know, this was the time when sort of socialism was at its height in the United States. You had industrialists getting bombed by radicals. In a few years, you'd have the Palmer raids, when Woodrow Wilson's attorney general would round up anarchists and socialists. And, you know, it was a time when the United States was very close to having open class warfare in the streets. You know, today, as you say, we have, you know, the richest 1% accounts for even more of the nation's income. So that was the early part of the 20th century. And it got a little better during World War I. It got worse in the 20s. And then starting after the 1929 crash, you saw a trend, a long trend in the United States towards greater income equality. You know, starting a little bit in the Depression and then very dramatically in the 1940s through the 1960s and into the early 70s. So really, you know, the norm for much of the 20th century was that America was becoming a more egalitarian society in terms of income. And, you know, as you'll recall, that was also a period, for much of that period, was extremely prosperous. You know, the post-war years through the 1960s were fantastically prosperous, but at the same time, American incomes were trending more equal. So any notion that you have to sort of there's some sort of trade-off between equality and prosperity is clearly nonsense. It's very possible that the opposite is true, is that the more widely income is shared, the more prosperous the nation as a whole is.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that trend towards equality, which ended in the early 70s, reversed itself by the late 1970s and has continued in reverse ever since. Ever since 1979, incomes have been growing less equal, not more. And, so now we're more than 30 years later, we are continuing that trend, and it's a very troubling one.
And you talk about the radicalism, the people marching in the streets, the great anger back in 1915. Is there any semblance of that kind of anger in 2010 when the disparity is even greater?
No, I think that there are quieter reactions among the public and less direct ones. I think there's a deep sense of alienation. I think there's a resentment of elites is an organizing principle of our politics to an extent that was unimaginable 50 years ago. The Tea Partiers, I think, obviously they are venting their frustration at government and at government spending, but I think that's probably because politicians are the most visible members of the elite, it's, I think, counterproductive for Tea Partiers to rage against government. But I think that some of the frustration is stemming from particularly the feature of what I call the Great Divergence, drawing on a term used by Paul Krugman. A major feature of that is stagnating incomes in the middle.
Mm-hmm. You looked at so many areas in this study: race, gender, the computer revolution, immigration, trade, government policies, labor unions, compensation policies on Wall Street and in executive suites, and education. And then you say, and then I explain why people who say we don't need to worry about income inequality, there aren't many of them, are wrong. Why do we need to worry about it?
We need to worry about it because I think the United States is breaking up into a number of kind of mutually suspicious subcultures. Great disparities in income make us strangers from one another. They make us less empathetic towards one another. There is less of a sense of shared purpose in our society. There is a kind of a festering resentment from among the have-nots that is vented in often, as I say, counterproductive ways, particularly against the government. When you look back, for example, at the 1940s, I'm a baby boomer. I belong to the generation that, had its ear bent by its parents about how great the post-war years were. And it's not just nostalgia. I mean, there was a greater sense of shared community in the country. Obviously, there were many things wrong about that community. It excluded blacks. To some extent, it excluded Jews. It was not completely hospitable to women, setting those matters aside, within the middle class, there was some sense of common purpose and common commitment to addressing the nation's problems, and I think that's harder to find today.
Mm-hmm. And some of the examples of this outrageous wealth are so striking, aren't they, these? And we tend to look at Wall Street here because we've had a lot of news about that the last year. But the amount of money some people are making, just your jaw drops and you say, what the heck? Why does anybody need that kind of money?
Well, there are actually two parts to the Great Divergence. And the first part that economists recognized was the growing gap between college graduates and non-college graduates, and that has proceeded since 1970, and it's stabilized a little bit in more recent years. But starting especially in the mid-1990s, you had a second part of the Great Divergence, which was, as you say, this phenomenal increase in incomes at the very, very top. And this was only discovered fairly recently, the extent of it, when two French economists, Emmanuel Saez, who recently won the John Bates Clark Medal, and Thomas Piketty, they set aside the census data that inequality researchers had been looking at, and they looked at IRS data instead, which is able to be more precise at the very, very top of the income scale. And what they found was that just a huge amount of income growth in the United States was concentrated not just in the top 1%, but in the top 0.1%.
Goodness.
And, you know, the top 0.1%, we're talking about, you know, people making more than $1 million a year.
Right.
If you are making more than $1 million a year, you are experiencing right now a gold rush.
What about, let's look at some of the areas here. The usual suspects, you say, are innocent. When we look at race and gender, they don't play as large a role in income inequality as many of us would have assumed they did.
Yes, they actually play, I argue, no role in this, which is not to say that, obviously it is true that there exists inequality between blacks and whites in terms of income, and there exists inequality between men and women. But the inequality between blacks and whites has not worsened over the last 30 years. It's stayed about the same. And the inequality between men and women has actually eased quite a bit over the last 30 years. And part of that is that women are increasingly better educated than men. Just this week, we learned that for the first time, more doctorates were being given to women than to men. And for many years, it's been true that there have been more women enrolled in universities than men. So I'm not saying that those aren't problems. They're just not part of this particular problem, being the growth in income inequality since 1979. You can't really pin it on gender. You can't really pin it on race. Now, the conservative argument on inequality, or a conservative argument on inequality, is that the rise in single-parent households has impoverished women. And it is true that there has been a growth in single-parent households over the last 30 years, although actually most of the growth was in the early part, and the start of the growth actually preceded the Great Divergence. So that's problematic. And it's also true that women as a whole have actually in the aggregate compensated for that economic disadvantage with an increase in wages. So that conservative explanation also doesn't seem to get you very far.
I found your piece on unions and fewer people in unions very interesting.
Yes, now that's I think one part of the puzzle that a lot of people that won't surprise a lot of people. It's been pretty obvious for some time that the within the private sector, the labor movement in the United States has been on the ropes for a very long time. In the public sector, public employee unions have become fairly powerful, but union membership overall has dropped from about 20% in 1983 to 7.5% in the private sector workforce. So, there has been this steep decline, and the question is, what does it mean when you have a less powerful labor movement? And obviously it means that, unions have less power to negotiate salary increases for their members. But there are also all sorts of indirect effects. And the two economists, Frank Levy and Peter Temlin, from MIT, talk about the Treaty of Detroit, which is a term they use to, broadly describe the an accord between industry and labor in the post-war years, where there was a mutual agreement that labor was a legitimate part of the industrial base, and that in exchange for that both sides would give a little bit in order to serve their mutual interests. And that didn't last. And it didn't last for a number of reasons, but one of the big reasons that, doesn't get talked about a lot was the Taft-Hartley Act, which was passed in 1947. And Taft-Hartley dealt a pretty severe blow to labor's ability to organize. It outlawed, you know, mass picketing, secondary strikes, and it we've heard a lot about card check in recent years. That was outlawed under Taft-Hartley. So labor's ability to organize was severely restricted under Taft-Hartley, and within a few years you saw labor entering the decline that it's been in ever since.
I want to look at taxation, because that's a dramatic part of the picture. It is amazing to look at what the top income bracket used to be and what President Reagan did with taxes. We have a caller who wants to address that, so we will get to that momentarily. Our phone number is, well, our lines are already jammed, so there's a great deal of interest in this topic, 800-486-8655. You eventually should be able to get through. If you'd like to send an email, that's okay. That's talk@WPR.org. Timothy Noah is our guest, senior writer for Slate Magazine, where he writes the Chatterbox column. He's a contributing editor to the Washington Monthly, and he's written a many-part segment in Slate on the Great Divergence, introducing the Great Divergence, looking at a number of possible reasons that the income inequality is so great now in this country, and also expressing why he believes that it's important that this be addressed and that it makes a difference to all of us in this country to have such income inequality. To your calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this Thursday, we will talk about electric cars. Gary in Chippewa Falls, our first caller. Hi, Gary.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Oh, beautiful day. I just wanted to ask, I know I grew up in the 60s and 70s. I was born in the 50s. One of the things that's always amazed me is how our tax rates have changed. And when I was growing up, the top wage earners got taxed at like 80, 70, 80, 90% of their income. And I was wondering if that wasn't a contributing factor to having people pay their employees more. Because, you know, if you're going to keep a dollar and only get a dime of it, why not give it to the employees? And along that same vein, I guess, as a taxpayer myself, and I'm not in that top 1%, and I can't understand why all these people are so upset at making the top 1% pay a little more tax when they gain the most from our country. And, I mean, how does that affect me? And I don't understand why people think that it's such an injustice that somebody that's making $1 million a day, like some people do, only pay an effective tax rate of 16.5%.
Timothy.
Hello.
Yes, go right ahead.
The tax situation is interesting. I one of the things that surprised me in my research is that the actually effective tax rates have changed over the last 30 years, but they haven't changed to anywhere near the extent you would expect, given the, as you say, very dramatic changes in the marginal tax rate. The top rate was 90%. During much of the Great Compression, which is a term that's used for to describe the period of growing equality after 1929, Kennedy lowered the top rate to 70%. Reagan lowered it to 50%, and then it gradually went down to 28%, and for the last decade or so, it's gone bounced between 30 and 40%. Those are pretty dramatic changes, but the changes in effective tax rate have not been nearly as large. So I think that the changes in the tax rate have contributed, but I don't think they've contributed a lot. Now, the flip side of that is that certainly we have learned that you can have marginal rates a whole lot higher, and we can have plenty of prosperity. So we should be thinking about probably creating new brackets for people, for the wealthiest people. The top bracket should recognize that people who make $1 million a year or more constitute practically a different species in terms of economic trends from people making $100,000 or $200,000. So I think that raising top brackets and maybe even putting in a few new brackets would be a good start. But I don't think that it would undo the great divergence. I think we need to think creatively about a host of changes to try and turn around the inequality trend. The real inequality trend, the biggest part of the inequality trend, comes before taxes.
Hmm. Before we get to those, can you explain a little more what you mean by effective tax rates?
Yes, effective tax rates are the marginal tax rate is what you pay on your last dollar. As you make more and more, you get bumped up into higher and higher brackets where you pay a larger percentage of your income in taxes. But what you actually end up paying overall is your effective tax rate. And it's affected by lots of things, including the fact that the wealthy have long devised a million ways to avoid paying taxes. There are lots of loopholes, and there are other considerations as well. So the impact of any marginal tax rate increase or decrease is likely to get muffled by a host of other factors. But that certainly is no argument against raising top rates.
Okay, we'll get to the major thing that would undo the great divergence in a moment. Let's go to another phone call. First, Matt from Toma. Hi.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Okay, how are you?
Good. I guess the only thing that I wanted to bring up to keep in mind is most but not all of the people in the top 1 and top 5% have laid out a significant risk to their well-being, and knowing if things didn't go well as far as starting businesses, making investments went, you know, they could have easily been in the middle or in the 90th percentile of earners. And it's just interesting to see, you know, the more successful you are, it's almost to see that you're penalized as far as, you know, you're talking about creating new tax brackets and things like that. So I just wanted to, you know, to kind of throw that out there as far as, you know, people being penalized for being successful.
Okay.
Well, you know, that's the mythology, and I'm sure it's true of some people, of entrepreneurs. But when you look at, you know, sort of who these new rich are, we don't know a lot about who they are, I should say, straight off. But it would appear, based at least on circumstantial evidence, that a whole lot of them are people on Wall Street. And Wall Street really is a game of you know, heads I win, tails you lose. There's been a lot written about how out of line incomes are, the reward system is for people on Wall Street. We saw this stunning thing where Wall Street really brought about this latest recession, but Wall Street was also the first part of the economy to recover from it, which I think tells you a lot about the mechanics of that sector. And it's an important sector. At one point in the aughts, finance constitutes something like 40% of all the corporate profits in America. So I think things are definitely out of whack, and I think you could make a similar argument for CEO pay, which I think is another significant component of this, is that you know, it's been documented time and time again that CEOs tend not to get punished for poor performance. Maybe eventually they'll lose their jobs, although often they don't. But certainly in terms of compensation, that also is kind of a heads I win, tails you lose type situation. So, yes, I won't deny that there are some people who get rich by putting their capital at risk. But I don't think that they constitute a significant portion of this group.
Thanks, Matt. Gene in Oshkosh. Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, guest. If any of my professional friends hear me, they'll never talk to me again. I think capitalism is broken. I taught finance for some 35 years in a number of different universities. I've never used a book. This was not my choice. I never used a book that didn't, in its preference, say the purpose of studying finance is to maximize wealth. And then wealth was not defined. You know, we can go back to the Mayflower Compact and probably way beyond that and realize that there are two major purposes for the existence of corporations. One is to segregate the personal wealth from the errors made in the business part of the human being, and the other is to pass on wealth so you don't have to destroy an entity because someone died. Those are really the two fundamental reasons for corporations. As an academic teaching finance, we really have turned out at least a generation of people who see themselves as managers, which means that they are totally different from the people who are actually producing the product and services. And they should be rewarded in huge amounts. There are very few colleges of business that teach things like business ethics. Mm-hmm. I know you can say, well, then whose ethics are you going to teach? But I guess my point simply is that we have badly, badly misused the corporate form of government in the activities of business, and we've allowed the managers, my ex-students, to see themselves as the anointed ones, and they should be compensated far, far more than the people who are actually out there doing the work.
Thank you so much for your call, Gene. Timothy.
Well, yes, I mean, I agree with that. I mean, corporations were, you know, the original, as you say, corporations were organized for particular purposes, and they receive protection in the form of limited liability, and in exchange, they should have some obligations, and that is what regulation is all about. And I think that part of the story here is and particularly in the financial world, is that there has been great reluctance on the part of government over the last 30 years to regulate. And I think the notion that corporations owe something to society in exchange for this great gift of limited liability, that we don't hear much about that anymore.
No, we don't. And it businesses acting in unethical ways or not thinking in ethical ways have gotten us into a heck of a lot of trouble lately.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. There's also been some research that has shown that that one of the things that that has put the economy at risk is that CEOs their compensation structure incentivizes them to take risks that are worth it to them based on the way that they are compensated, but potentially quite risky for the economy at large.
Here's something you deal with in your piece in Slate. So I'd like to read this email from Paul in Menominee. Seems to me you're missing the elephant in the room. Large numbers of immigrants since 1970 who are poor, drive down wages, and exporting labor-intensive jobs overseas.
I did write one of the installments, looked at the immigration question, and there is no doubt it is very striking that this 30-year trend coincides with a trend of increased immigration stemming from the 1965 liberalization of immigration in the United States. But it's been very difficult. Economists have had a very difficult time relating this to the Great Divergence. When you look at individual labor markets, you find that it's really hard to see much impact at all. Even after the 1980 Mariel boat lift, when Fidel Castro sent 125,000 Cubans to Miami. The city's labor force was expanded by 7%, but it was found to have virtually no measurable effect on wages. Now, there is an economist named George Borjas at Harvard who has said that's the wrong way to look at it. He says you need to look at the economy nationally, because when a lot of immigrants flock to one place, then native workers who can't compete move somewhere else. So he looked at the question nationally, and what he found was, yes, there has been an impact on wages, but the impact has been largely concentrated on high school dropouts, a fairly small group of people in the United States, and they have seen their wages depressed by about 7% annually. So there has been an impact on the poorest workers, but there hasn't been much of a measurable impact on the middle class, which is really the group that this great divergence trend is much more about. So Borjas, who is a pretty conservative guy when it comes to immigration. He says, I think that immigration is a contributor. This isn't a quote. This is a paraphrase. He says, I think it's a contributor, but is it the biggest contributor? No, I would say it isn't.
John in Glendale. Hi.
Good morning. I do hope that both you and your guest read old GM plants linger on amid blight and scavenging. Yesterday's Above the Fold New York Times story by Mr. Vlasic and Mr. Bunkley. The decrease in wages in the United States is one clear-cut cause, and that is the war on organized labor. And I use the word war. A lot of people, even in organized labor, our state federation president and vice president, don't acknowledge this war that we've been experiencing as workers since Nixon, and it really got going under Mr. Reagan, certainly under Bush 1, Mr. Clinton with NAFTA, and Bush 2. And until we get our manufacturing base back in this country, until these old factories in Flint and Janesville and in Milwaukee get re-engineered, retooled, and start re-employing workers, we're just spinning our wheels in this country. And the reality of the situation is that we in organized labor bear part of the responsibility for this. But for Michael Moore, there hasn't been a spokesman, or there have been those of us out on the streets, but we don't get press coverage. But we haven't been pushing this issue, and now we have the two most virulent anti-union candidates in the history of this state, Mr. Scott Walker and Rebecca Clayfish, leading the ticket for the state Republican Party. And it's going to be very interesting to see if anyone brings out the fact that Mr. Walker's first legislative act when he got to the legislature in January of 1993 was to affix his name to Margaret Farrow's state right to work bill.
Timothy.
Well, as I said earlier, yes, I think there has been a concerted effort on the part of government to suppress labor, and as I say, I would date it back to the Taft-Hartley law in 1947. That's really when it began. Ronald Reagan certainly stepped it up with his policies. And government has not been especially hospitable to labor ever since. I don't know where you go with that. This is certainly it is certainly a case that we have taken a very different path from Germany. Tom Gagin, who is a labor lawyer in Chicago, has a book called "Were You Born on the Wrong Continent," and he talks about Germany, and he says. He says the Germans don't have the illusion that I'm quoting now don't have the illusion that they can bust the unions in the U.S. manner as the prime way of competing with China and other countries. It's no accident the social democracies, Sweden, France, and Germany, which kept on paying high wages, now have more industry than the U.S. or the U.K. That's what the U.S. and U.K. did. They smashed the unions in the belief that they had to compete on cost. The result, they quickly ended up wrecking their industrial base. You know, that's not what happened in Germany. Germany kept its industrial base; it remains a world leader in manufacturing, not coincidentally, has recovered more quickly from the current recession than the United States has.
John brings up politics. One of the areas that you look at is blaming this on Republicans. Liberal politicians and activists have long argued, you write, that the federal government caused the Great Divergence, and by federal government, they generally mean Republicans who controlled the White House for 20 of the past year, 30 years, after all. A few outliers even argue that for Republicans, creating income inequality was a conscious and deliberate policy goal. Expand, please.
Yeah, there's a very interesting study that was done by a Princeton political scientist named Larry Bartels, where he just looked at income growth for the five groups, from the poorest to the wealthiest, and he found that under Democrats, you saw progressively more income growth as you went down the income scale, and that for Republicans it was the opposite. You saw progressively more income growth as you went up the income scale. It's pretty dramatic, and he was looking at the years 1948 to 2005. It's pretty dramatic. There does seem to be a very dramatic difference between the way Democrats govern, Democratic presidents govern, and Democratic and Republican presidents govern. If only Democrats, based on this data, he projected that if only Democrats had occupied the White House since 1948, there would have been no Great Divergence. And if only Republicans had occupied the White House since 1948, not only would there have been the Great Divergence, but it would have been somewhat worse than the one we had. Now, the there's a caveat to that, which is that the partisan difference in inequality between the way Democratic presidents govern and Republican presidents govern, that partisan difference breaks down as you get to the very top. For the very rich, policies under Democrats and Republicans don't seem to have differed all that much, at least in terms of their effect. The very rich, what I call in my series, the stinking rich, people making more than $1 million a year, have done phenomenally well under Democrats and Republicans alike.
Because they're giving them a lot of money?
Well, there's some interesting research in a new book called "Winner Take All Politics" by Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson, where they argue that the reason there's no partisan difference at the very top is that really reflects the huge impact of corporate spending and corporate lobbying in Washington. Um, they they kind of dig into history a bit, and they find that really what happened was in the early 1970s, corporate America got really scared. It really felt as if it was being outgunned in Washington. You know, sort of liberalism was kind of at a high watermark then. And they made a very deliberate and conscious effort to put a huge amount of resources into creating lobby groups and expanding the Chamber of Commerce, and all sorts of measures were taken in the 1970s. And Hacker and Pearson argue, I think pretty persuasively, that they were so successful at it that really the lobby pressure, corporate lobby pressure, manages to achieve for the very rich policies that aren't all that different for Democrats or Republicans.
Timothy Noah, his series, The United States of Inequality, is in Slate, and he is a senior writer for Slate magazine. He writes the Chatterbox column. He's a contributing editor to the Washington Monthly. He's also the editor of two collections of writings by his late wife, Marjorie Williams, who's author of the award-winning The Woman at the Washington Zoo, his book won awards here, and also Reputation, both published by Public Affairs. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. The second hour of the program, both of our guests join us by phone from Iceland, where they're attending a major conference on electric cars. I know there's deep interest in that topic among our listeners, so it should be a good hour. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, Jeff from Madison. Hi.
Hi. Thanks. This is really fascinating. I appreciate your guest's thoughts. They're very incisive. I was just thinking when he started, he mentioned, as many do, something about the greatest generation. We often hear about that, perhaps because of Tom Brokaw's book, but this always seems to be sort of accompanied by a requisite nostalgia for some lost time, and then that nostalgia is generally followed by an admission that some groups didn't share in those successes, et cetera. But I was just wondering that isn't this nostalgia possibly or simply a longing for white America, and one that didn't really have to consider anybody else's status, minorities, women. And it seems to me that the election of our president has shown that, you know, first of all, a return to those days is not possible. We are different. A return is not possible as it shouldn't be, but this seems to have generated this, perhaps this is the root of this incredible bitterness on the part of those who maintain this nostalgia for a time that, you know, was hardly humane to a huge part of our population. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are about that, and whether it isn't time to sort of put this greatest generation metaphor to bed. And I'll listen off the air.
All right. Thank you so much for your call, Jeff.
I hear you about the feeling a bit tired about hearing about the greatest generation, but yes, we cannot set the clock back and recreate that world, which was based to some extent on exclusion. But you know, just looking at that, you know, at that white, largely Christian world of the 1940s and 50s, you know, compare it to the white, largely Christian world of the 1930s or the 1920s. Those were obviously very different kinds of times. The 1930s were a very troubled period of economic calamity, and the 1920s were a period of great prosperity, but prosperity that was not widely shared. And we don't look back, I think, on the 1920s as a time of great national unity and great unified sense of purpose. We think of it as a time where, you know, some people got very rich and a lot of people got left behind, and there is a kind of nostalgia for the 1920s too, but it's certainly not any kind of nostalgia about a shared sense of national purpose. So it's all relative. I think that what what is good about, you know, the period of the 1940s through the early 1970s is that even among the relatively diverse subgroups within white Christian America, you had a greater sense of shared purpose than you had had before, and then you've seen since. So we can want to try and recreate that in a different way that is more inclusive of people of different races and genders. We can want that. I think it's a realistic goal.
Thank you for your call. Our time is running short. It's flown by. I don't want to get to the end of the hour without hearing from you about what would have the greatest impact in undoing the Great Divergence.
Well, it's funny. That's the one part of the puzzle that I didn't really address in my series. How do we reverse it? It's a big question. I certainly think that raising taxes on these newly wealthy folks would be a good start. But we really have to do a whole host of things, and it's very hard to pinpoint one thing. I mean, one slightly glib answer that would deal not with the folks at the very top, but with the say the bottom 95% and creating greater equality there is simply to put more Democrats in the White House, based on Larry Bartels' research. But the increase in income at the very top is a different phenomenon that requires its own solution. And perhaps we need tighter regulation of Wall Street. Perhaps we need to empower stockholders to limit executive pay. I'm not very clear on what the solutions are, but I think that understanding what got us here is a good first step to addressing it.
How about a massive retreat for those who are in the way in the upper reaches here, and have them spend a good portion of time taking sort of a summer camp in ethics and what would happen if to the country as a whole if they didn't make as much money?
Well, I suspect a lot of them already are quite familiar with the ethics of their situation.
Do you think so?
Yes, I do, actually. I recently read Michael Lewis's book about the financial meltdown of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
He describes, you know, his characters as they come to sort of understand how things are working in the world of finance. It sort of radicalizes them.
Right,
they make
right.
a fortune of money by betting against credit default swaps, but
yes.
they're appalled by the situation.
Right. Yeah, it's a great book. John is next from Eagle River. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you? I've got a scattered shot of quick questions or comments. I have a nephew, a doctor, who makes about $800,000 a week.
Woo!
And it took us, I don't know how many hundred years, to get to a minimum wage. Is there a chance that we could get to a maximum wage and cap wages? The other points I want to make is I don't think the real wealthy people are against paying greater taxes. I think it's the legislators, mainly Republican, but some Democrats, who are trying to curry their favor and save them money. And let's see what other points. The Supreme Court's decision recently about letting corporations spend as much as they want on campaigns is outrageous. But I'd like your thoughts on that. And are all pieces of legislature, both in state legislatures and the federal government, are they just pieces of legislature bought and paid for by lobbyists and big corporations and wealthy people?
All right, and we only have a minute, Timothy.
Well, I would just say, yes, the Supreme Court decision on campaign contributions by corporations is obviously very destructive and going to contribute to this trend of growing corporate influence over our politics. I'll leave it at that.
All right. Very good. Thank you, John, very much for your call. we ended even a little bit early here. We have many, many emails, very thoughtful emails that have come in that we don't have time to read, Timothy. So if you don't mind, I know you'd like to hear some of these thoughts. We'll just send them to you.
That would be great. Thank
okay,
you very much.
Because I think you'll like that. So where do you go after this? Are you filled with a sense of, I got to do something about this?
I really tried very hard in writing this series to just sort of understand the problem. I feel that this, when this subject is written about, it's often written about in a sense of high outrage that doesn't really help you understand, you know, what it is we know about what this trend is. So I'm really interested at this point only in understanding as fully as I can how we got here. I think that would be a contribution in itself.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Timothy Noah, senior writer for Slate Magazine. He writes the Chatterbox column. He's a contributing editor to the Washington Monthly. He has worked as a congressional correspondent for Newsweek and a staff writer of The New Republic. He's the editor of two collections of writings by his late wife, Marjorie Williams, the award-winning The Woman at the Washington Zoo and Reputation, both published by Public Affairs. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this interesting show, and to Chrissy as well for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. News up, and we'll return on the Ideas Network.